Good morning and welcome to the Preventing Grace podcast for November 9th, 2020. The apocalypse. I guess it came and went and we're fine now. Or something. Anyway, actually yesterday at church somebody said, you know, it's concerning, like, how was your week? As if, like, terrible things had happened. And I was like, I don't know what, my week was fine. What are you talking about? And then I remember there was an election. It's already gone from my mind. In other words, I've moved on emotionally.
Yeah. Although it's still not over.
It's not over, but I don't care.
Because all the votes aren't counted.
I know. But again, I don't care.
I did mention that there are people who, and I used to be one of these people, so I know what it's like. I still do this, I used to stay up all night on the election night, and everything at the end of the year hinged on whether my person won or not. If my person lost, or my party lost, I'd be, like, devastated and tired because I stayed until 3 o'clock in the morning. But if he won, it was, like, the best thing in the world. That's when the next day, next week, just, like, kind of gloating, going to liberal websites and watching, or liberal social media people, and just enjoying their personal devastation, which is really unchristian. I was a bad person.
Yeah.
Now I stay up in the morning, and I still feel bad when my candidate I want to win loses, or when the candidate that I want to win wins. I'm overjoyed, but I'm not as
mean.
Well, I'm not as crushed to the earth if I lose. Like, so this, I mean, I don't know yet, because the votes aren't counted, so I'm not gonna jump on the media.
Yeah, I think we should be, like, we should just continue in the lull that exists.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not gonna go out and congratulate Kamala Harris for becoming president, because
yeah,
there's not, there's still contesting certain things.
Right.
So, which, I mean, I fully expect that all those contestations will be a loss for Mr. Trump, and that's fine.
I don't know, but who, if they are, then we'll start with, there's, like, this parade of evangelicals who had been pushing against voting for Trump, and even some pushing for voting for Biden, who are just falling all over themselves to say, oh, isn't it wonderful that we have a woman of color who's our president, and we should be so proud that we have this. I mean, I personally think it's the most racist thing an evangelical can say, because this woman of color also happens to be pushing the murder of babies all the way up until birth. So, I mean, I don't care what color you are. I don't care if you're black. I don't care if you're white. I don't care if you're an Indian person. I don't care if you are a woman or a man. You're a murderer. You're promoting murder. So it's a little bit like, oh, the Nazis had a large number of women serving as death camp guards.
I know, you already said that
on
Twitter.
How wonderful that is.
And you've already ruined my art. Like, you just went straight for the jugular. Like, I had...
Sorry.
Let's just back up off this, like, you're not really as invested as you used to be. So, first of all, that, you just debunked that yourself.
I'm not, you know, this is a non-invested man.
Okay.
You should have,
I don't even want to know what real investment looks like. Okay, well, you ruined my whole art, because what I was enjoying, I don't really think it's the apocalypse if Mr. Biden wins or Mr. Trump, because both of them are so bad, as I've been saying for the last 4 years. But what I have enjoyed, I'm sorry, there's plenty to enjoy today. And yes, because initially there was the, oh yeah, congratulations to Kamala Harris for becoming the next president. That's literally everywhere, even from Christians who are excited about it. But we can always depend on, according to Twitter, Dr. Naomi Wolf. I trust people remember who Naomi Wolf is. She's the one who thought that thousands and thousands of homosexual people in Britain had been killed by the law in the 1800s. She went through, she did some kind of research, and she didn't understand the words that she was reading on the page, wrote like a book, a dissertation length book, in which she misunderstood key elements, key words in the law, and thought that something that the British government had put to death thousands and thousands of gay men. And it was somebody like this, it was like on
this genocide of
gay men. Twitter, somebody on Twitter was like,
wait a minute,
that's not what that word means. And her book was, had already been like, like no one editing the book
knew that that word
knew that. Like nobody looked it up, nobody Googled it. So here's Naomi Wolf, yesterday morning, which is so epically, she tweets, if I'd known Biden was open to lockdowns, as he now states, which is something historically unprecedented in any pandemic and a terrifying practice, one that won't ever end because elites love it, I would never have voted for him. And the person I was like, people are like, LOL, what? You know that, like, Mr. Biden and Madam Kamala Harris said literally lots of things before the election about transgenderism and abortion and gay marriage and the economy and coronavirus. They said a lot of things. Yeah, and if you wanted to know what they said, you could, like, literally just Google it, and you would know that a lot of those things are awful things. So I get that you're upset about Mr. Trump. Get it. But, like, Mr. Biden also sucks. That was the whole point.
Right.
That it really, you didn't need to throw your weight behind Mr. Biden, because he's also, and maybe just a tiny bit more awful than the president that exists
now. I love it. This is from Danny Akin, who also was, like, just carrying the water for the Biden campaign, basically, during the thing. He's a big time sort of Baptist person.
Well, but again, everybody says, "Oh, I'm not voting for Mr. Biden."
No, I know, but they
don't spending most of their time bad.
Punching right, spending yeah. most of their time like trying to. So, Daniel Akin, I have grave concerns about Joe Biden restoring transgender access to sports bathrooms and locker rooms. It is unfair and dangerous for biological males to compete against biological females in sports. It is unwise and unsafe to do the same in bathrooms and locker rooms. Hashtag wrong.
Hashtag wrong.
And then Dwight McKissick. Dwight McKissick.
I don't know who that is.
He is wokey with McWokeface. He's like he is the wokest of the wokes evangelicals. And he writes, once I read the document that makes it evident that indeed that's President-elect Joe Biden's intent, I plan to fight this with every fiber of my being. Dude, he said this.
He said it.
It was a plank. It was a part of his platform. He said the first like 100 days is one of the things he's going to do is push the transgender thing with the Equality Act.
Which is also incidentally
the evangelical church across racial lines ought to be able to stand together to oppose this matter. Thanks for speaking out.
What? But why didn't you do it like a week ago?
A.B. Roble said, who has a chip on his shoulder about quote unquote Big Eva. Said that he gives it like 5 days. He said this before the election. He said if Biden wins, give it like 5 days or less, and there's going to be a huge, massive pivot where these evangelical leaders try to regain their credibility by speaking out against.
So here's the thing, because a lot of people felt like people who carried the water for Trump lost their credibility in the last 4 years, and I think that's definitely true. People who like were putting their big arms wide around Trump all the time, just Trump is our savior, Trump is Cyrus, lost credibility. Okay, but you know what? There's a way not to lose your credibility in this day and age, and that's to admit, like, call evil out as evil when you see it.
Yeah.
And don't, like, Mr. Biden isn't a good candidate.
Right.
It just.
Right.
And neither was Mrs. Clinton.
Right.
So you shouldn't have voted for Mrs. Clinton, and you shouldn't have voted for Mr. Biden, probably, I would guess. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you.
And I understand not voting for Mr. Trump either. But if you're, yeah. I would say the best.
But don't, like, if point. You're not voting for Mr. Trump, don't go running to Mr. Biden and be like, I love you, I love you, I love you. He's not a good guy for you.
Right.
He's not a nice, sweet man. Right. And Madam Kamala Harris, also not a nice person. And, like, if you think that I, speaking as a woman, need to be, you know, charmed and delighted that she may be ascending into the White House, You've misunderstood, you know, like I.
Jadis was a woman. The White Witch. Oh, yeah. But she was white, though.
I know. So.
There are lots of, I mean, women in
one
power.
One thing that I wanted to have happen the last time around and it didn't happen is that I wanted all Americans to look at the two choices that God gave us and corporately say, mm-hmm. I'm so sorry. We have sinned and fallen short of the glory of God. That's mm-hmm. what I wanted Americans to mm-hmm. say. God has put before us two candidates who do reflect who we are. And we are very sad about that reflection. We've looked into the mirror. We feel very, very sad. God, please come help us. But again, that's still not happening. Like, people are not deeply sorry and deeply grieved about who we are. As a corporate body.
Yeah, it wasn't a question, you know, okay, we, if Biden wins, we're a nation under judgment, or if Trump wins, we're a nation under judgment. We're a nation under judgment. That's what we have.
That's why we have to pick between these two people.
Which form of judgment is it going to take? Are we going to have fast judgment? Are we going to have slower judgment? Are we going to have judgment where we kill our babies? Or are we going to have judgment where we slow down the killing of babies, but keep killing babies? What kind of judgment is it going to be? And are we getting a judgment where you blaspheme marriage or a judgment where you blaspheme marriage? Because both of them had the same.
They're
both the same way in that. So, yeah, it's just.
Being forced to make
what this kind choice. Of hell are we going to have?
Yeah. So, we were sent a good article. Did you read it?
Which one? Before you go into that. AOC says she might quit politics as some centrist Democrats blame progressives for House losses. Yeah, that is one fun thing to. Okay, so if I were my old self and were going to gloat at the weeping and wailing of my enemies, which I'm not doing, I'm not doing that. I don't want to do this.
You look.
Then the House gains for the Republicans completely reverse what the Democrats expected. They thought that. The Democrats thought they would gain seats in the House. They've lost them. In fact, it's almost a Republican House now. And in the Senate, they thought they would take that too, and they're not taking it. So there's lots of weeping and wailing. And whatever, however you say her name, Cortez, is thinking she might quit because people were being mean to her.
You know,
because,
she's not going
because
to.
People
though.
Saw what she was saying and said, I don't want that.
She's going to dig down deep, though, and she's going to find the strength to carry on. But that's nice. Okay, so this is a really interesting article from sciencedaily.com. It's called The Problem with Solving Problems. The prevalence, I think it's prevalence, is it prevalence? Prevalence-induced concept change. That's the name of something. Prevalence-induced concept causes people to redefine problems as they are reduced. So I'm going to link this because it's so great. It's hard. It's very sciencey sounding, which means it must be true. But basically, these people did a experiment, or they had a hypothesis. They figured out that as problems go away, human people redefine what the problem is so that they can keep having a problem. So they did some stuff with blue dots
and purple dots. And when there were lots of blue dots, people made clear distinctions between the purple and the blue.
Right.
But then when they took away some of the blue dots, and the more they took away the blue dots, they even paid people. They said, we'll pay you if you can
find
just the blue dots. They began identifying purple dots as actually blue dots.
Because they needed the cash. Just kidding.
Well, no. They were saying we're going to pay you to do an accurate thing, and they couldn't do it.
They couldn't do it. So the part... Well, this was a nice line. We asked participants to review proposals for studies that varied from highly ethical to highly unethical. Over time, we lowered the prevalence of unethical studies. And sure enough, when we did that, our participants started to identify innocuous studies as unethical. In some cases, Gilbert said, prevalence-induced concept change makes perfect sense in this case of an emergency room doctor trying to triage. If the ER is full of gunshot victims and someone comes in with a broken arm, the doctor will tell that person to wait. But imagine one Sunday where there are no gunshot victims. Hmm. Should the doctor hold her definition of needing immediate attention constant and tell the guy with a broken arm to wait anyway? Of course not. She should change her definition based on this new concept. However, that doesn't work all the time. Make it about cancer. Mm-hmm. And you don't want the radiologist to keep finding the same rate of tumors when there are tumors.
Yeah, zapping tumors that aren't there because
you need to keep. Right. I thought this was brilliant because it confirms my own confirmation bias that I've been working on all year, which is that the fewer problems you have, the more unhappy you are. Mm-hmm. Like, I think this speaks directly to the happiness level. When you remove all the friction from life, you don't end up with people who
are happy. I think this explains this is wokeism, because we're gonna find racism. This explains microaggression, right?
Yeah, so, microaggression.
So it's not that you're actually racist. It's just that they've got to find racism. It's not that people are actually sexist. They've got to find sexism. It's not that people are trying to oppress. They've got to find oppression.
Or discrimination.
Right. And it's not that, maybe once a long time ago, some woman was really offended by words spoken in the classroom, and they were maybe really offensive, but now... there's no really offense cause, but they've got to find offense because it's part of who they are.
Well,
now.
It goes with
they redefine the problem.
Like the Coddling of the American Mind book, which was so, so good. They said, Americans have kind of bought into three, I can never remember all three of them, three untruths, which one of them is whatever doesn't kill you makes you weaker. My side versus your side. I'm right and you're wrong. There are no, what that was, is it, we're not debating about ideas. There are good people and bad people. And I'm a good person and you're a bad person. So this tribalism, that it's not just, we're not just talking about ideas. We're joining together in groups to fight other groups.
It's not just about, the Ides of March is not just about stabbing.
Right. It's coming together in groups.
To stab.
And what was the third one? I can never remember the third one. Follow your feelings. That's right. Your feelings are always an accurate measure of reality. And they work that through, how that's changed the way that Americans, their posture towards reality, basically.
Right.
And you... yeah, that's
because before, I mean, just 20 years ago, you were encouraged to really look at a problem, so don't let your feelings interfere with your assessment of what's really going on. Your feelings often get in the way of that, so try and measure and weigh the problem objectively. And everyone knew, even 20 years ago, that total objectivity is impossible, but that you could at least surmount your passions and ride herd on them to get a basic understanding of reality. But now, nope.
No.
Your reality is your passion.
Your feelings are the full and true measure of everything that's happening to you all the time.
Right.
Which is how you get crazy, dangerous stuff about transgenderism, because the reality and objective measure of biology is completely gone away.
Right.
And how you feel has hold sway over your own body. So.
I was saying how that explains kind of wokeism, but you were saying how that explains something else. Was that
it does in our show prep. I do think like the high rise of anxiety, particularly among, I'm going to call myself middle class. And I'm white, so that's my demographic. I probably am a soccer mom because I've like literally driven my kids to soccer.
In a minivan.
But I found that my own anxiety has risen in proportion to the ease of my life. Like as my kids have gotten bigger and they can do more stuff for themselves and I'm not like overwhelmed by the physical labor of early childhood caregiving. And I have more free time and more say over how my life can go. That hasn't made all that freedom hasn't made me happier as a person.
Yeah.
Like, and the people, my friends, the people I see all the time have high levels of anxiety and depression. But life is, you know, even in coronavirus, I wouldn't say that I like actually suffered. And most people I know didn't physically suffer. The emotional, I don't want to use the word trauma because trauma is a real thing, but like coronavirus has been really difficult for people, you know, that I know personally, including myself.
Right.
It's been horrible. Let's just say it that way. And the Western world in particular has just melted down over coronavirus. In our comfortable, well-temperatured homes with washing machines, like this wasn't the bubonic plague,
right,
where we had to take our people out into the street, right, like when the cart of dead people walked by and you throw your relative out the window.
But it's causing anxiety at that like, level, right?
It might as well have been the Black Plague,
right,
for how we've been able to emotionally cope with it.
Right. I mean, that's the same thing in the church. You know, we relatively, given in the context of the kind of fights we've had at Good Shepherd over things like sexuality in the past, like where like, you know, half the church leaves or we leave our building and we, you know, just terrible fights, right? Over really essential issues. We haven't had that for, you know, 10 years, 15 years. And we haven't had major, for the last 2 or 3 years, we haven't had major conflicts within the congregation at all. We've had disciplinary issues, but nothing approaching what it was like.
And there's been money and good ministry going on.
Yeah, but see, I get more anxious now than I think I did then. I'm not sure what it was. I mean, I was not as anxious when we lost like 20 people after I preached about it.
I know. You were very young at the time. God will provide.
Now, like a leaf rustles in the wind and I'm, the church is dead.
Yeah.
Everyone's leaving. Everyone hates me.
Yeah.
We're done.
We're done.
We're going to live in a van down by the river. Pack up, kids.
It's all over. Yeah. I mean, you'd think that the test of time, that you'd see how God's provision over time, you know, provides, and so we can trust him, and like he obviously isn't trying to kill the church, and that a life of faith and trouble. So here's the one where I feel like when somebody says to me, what doesn't kill you makes you stronger, I always say, no, I'm much, much weaker than I was. Every bad thing that's happened to me has made me weaker, more fragile. more anxious. And I say me in like a bigger sense too. Like, I'm, the people I know and love are, wouldn't probably characterize themselves as super strong, robust, together, people.
Yeah.
Mostly they would talk about anxiety and unhappiness and stress. So I just think it's really interesting. I don't know. The article was helpful. The mind insists on trouble, you know? The human mind needs misery.
And where it doesn't have it,
it'll make it up for itself so that it can keep going. And I'm just curious about what the spiritual implications of that.
God knowing this about all of us and seeing how ridiculously anxious we always are when he gives us big problems, it's not necessarily... It's almost like giving us something to really worry about.
I know.
Okay,
maybe
guys,
it's like mercy.
Worry about this.
Here.
Worry about.
Here's a horrible election for you to think about for the next 10 years. Pick between these two terrible people.
So, it's fascinating.
I don't know what this...
And then you had another article you were reading about tribalism, which is...
Yeah.
Which was about how... This is a person who spent his life in Africa... And talking about the conflicts between tribes that become so bloody, or one tribe will just go through the village of another and murder everybody they can, and Westerners looking into that sometimes think,
how could that ever happen?
Yeah, we have this kind of sense of superiority. Oh wow, well that how barbarous! We would never
do that.
But then this author was saying, there's two things that prompt that. One is if one tribe sees another as totally disconnected from it, so they're not bound up as common human beings with the other tribe. But then second, the fear that if the other tribe gained the ascendancy, they intend to and would destroy you. And so you can't let that happen. You've got to defend yourself. You have the power to destroy the other tribe. You have to do it or else you'll be destroyed.
So it's a zero-sum game.
Right. So there's no sense of common humanity and no sense of any good being or any mercy or possibility of peace with the other side. And this author was saying, well, you kind of see that developing here. It's not something that's like just African. It's human.
No, it's human.
And it's something that's developing here in the sense that... the zero-sum game of politics
and like you were saying this last night, the real trouble, the great badness of right now is that, and everybody has noticed this for the last 4 years, everything is political. Politics has become the only conversation in the American world. So there's no football, because football is now
politics.
There's no religion. Religion is now about politics. There's no...
You can't escape it.
There's no just being quietly in your living room, watching your shows. Your shows are political.
There's no science.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you can't, like, okay, when I was growing up, and probably people who are my age remember this, you could, you watch the news, and that's where you got your politics, or you heard about the political situation.
Then you turned off the news.
And you watched a football game, and it was just about football. And so it was kind of a release, a break. Or you went to school and college. Of course, my professors were liberal, but so if you took a history class, you had to watch out for that. But not all of them were liberal, for one. And two, there was kind of fairness, I got the sense from my professors, and I went to a liberal arts college, two liberal arts colleges, that they were really trying to get to tell me what actually happened and explain why without putting an ideological lens on it. So you kind of had a break from politics. You could, we can study, I took a class on Vietnam, and I know my professor was several classes on Vietnam War, and my professor was very liberal about it, but he also did the best he could. I could tell he was stifling his own ideology to try and understand both sides of the question and help us write papers that were not political position papers on the Vietnam War. And it was very good. It was, I don't think that kind of class is even possible anymore.
No, because if you don't take a position, you aren't a good human being.
Right.
Like your goodness or relative badness is always under consideration. The merits right. of who you are in yourself. There's like a new essentialism about the person.
Yeah.
You have to be, there's no neutral. You can't sort of approach the world, you know, as a flawed, but, you know, interesting person.
Right.
Your establishing of your own goodness or badness at every moment of the day is the key
yeah.
measure. And the relative badness of all the other people. So
I mean, it's kind of character. Yeah. So you go to a science class like biology, and you're going to have an initial wokeness discussion. How woke are you? And I've heard people say you can't in public school or in private school in college. And especially actually in the undergrad or upper postgraduate studies, there is such a veil of thorns you have to walk through in order to be accepted as someone who can study a particular subject that it's not actual study anymore.
Right. It's all.
Yeah.
The next thing I'm supposed to be writing about is virtue signaling.
That's how, well, yeah, it's virtue, yeah, it's about, yeah, it's and, all, this is virtue signaling.
Yeah.
You have to say where you, in it.
But it's taken on, it's like metastasized into this just giant looming hole.
Well, it's interesting because you read accounts of what life was like in China or the Soviet Union, and that's exactly how it was. There wasn't just history, there was socialist history. There wasn't just or a socialist philosophy of history. So you couldn't study events neutrally. You had to adopt the Marxist framework of history, and then you could study history from within that framework. It's a little bit, it's like what we do when we tell people not to do in studying the Bible is you don't eisegete, you don't come into the Bible with a philosophy and then read everything from that philosophy. You let the Bible shape your understanding of things. Well, that's what's happening. We've become eisegetes of everything. You can't do neutral history. You have to be the people's history. You can't do neutral philosophy. There's good philosophers and there's bad philosophers, and you need to make sure you understand who those are. So you can't do neutral music studies. Mm-hmm. You have to have a racial understanding of what good music. So Bach
is black. Had to be.
He's a racist. Is it?
Yo, yeah. So, I was singing Beethoven. Wondering if Beethoven is black. Sorry.
Oh well. Yeah. All right. So you have to have an ideological lens on it. It's not just studying music. It's the people's music. So it's very similar to that. We don't have the Cheka or the NKVD to enforce these things, but it's coming.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I guess Facebook and Twitter can be kind of
are kind of that
yeah.
way. Yes. Well, we fixed that thing. I thought we were going to talk about because it doesn't matter who is the next president. It doesn't matter.
Oh, everything matters. Everything hinges on that baby.
No, it doesn't matter. I think Christians can, there's a way to be Christian right now that doesn't give into this
right.
kind of thing. Rod Dreher would say, buy my book. Every article he writes right now is like he quotes extensively from his book about how to survive the oncoming apocalypse. But surely there's some way to de-escalate and not to manufacture more problems where they don't live. Like, how can we survive whatever happens this week as Christians? Do you have any ideas?
Well, I mean, I think, okay, so
I was thinking of like just perseverating, continuing to perseverate and read the internet unrelentingly and then eat my feelings and like feel really, really, really sad and basically do nothing differently than I've been doing it.
That's good.
Is that your recommendation for
yeah.
me?
Yeah, that's good. I mean, I do think it's interesting. I talked to this morning, yesterday during announcements on Sunday, that I've noticed that during COVID, a lot of Christians have not doubled down on their prayers and Bible study. Like, you have time now, but it has not produced, okay, let me use the time that I have to draw closer to Jesus.
Are you shocked by that?
Well, I am, because we go to a church where we emphasize personal Bible study as well as corporate, and personal prayer as well as corporate. And I've said this, thousands of times, that often when people come to me, not often, almost every single time when people come to me in need of pastoral counseling, and I ask them, so tell me about your prayer life. The, you know, the eye contact stops and the looking down and the, well, I haven't prayed for, you know, a month. Yeah, okay, that's part of the problem. Or I haven't read my Bible for a month. Yeah, you're not eating. That's what they tell you. You're not eating food and you're not drinking water. You're so yeah, you're going to feel bad. That's what happens spiritually to Christians who don't do that, because you're not designed to go without food and water. You need that, your new creation, and your new creation has different kinds of things you feed on. And one of those things is the Bible. And one of those things is prayer. And you're not availing yourself of those means of grace. You're letting yourself die. So I do think that doubling down on self-discipline in those areas. I'm not saying you're sinning.
You sound like Rachel Hollis right now.
Huh?
You sound like Rachel Hollis.
I'm
no, I'm kidding. Like her thing about habits was, it wasn't about Christian habits at all, but it was absolutely really like, if you have to hear it from Rachel Hollis, that's fine. Get it where you need it. And that's what you have to build, the habit of, like, you should take some exercise for your body.
Yeah.
You should take some exercise for your mind, control your mind and your feelings, right. Exercise discipline over your mind and feelings, and discipline yourself to prayer and the study of scripture. Because if you don't do that, when things are really, really bad, you won't have anything. You can't begin those things when you're in a crisis. You have to begin them before the crisis and have them as the crutches that help you limp through a terrible thing. I was angry about this, but oh my goodness, I'm probably gonna have to get this. We're gonna have to wrap things up in a minute. But when the truck went missing from my parents, or not, when it was stolen, what am I, like, passive voice? When it was stolen by a bad, wicked person, and I, like, we were plunged into chaos, really, and just like profound grief, which reemerges every now and then, because it actually hasn't been that long. What enraged me was that as I read the Bible over those days and weeks, and continue to, the words leap out off the page in a very fresh and immediate way.
Hmm.
Some ways that increase the grief, like would bring it back up. But there, the way that you read is not the way that you read. When you read the Bible, you don't need to, like, worry that it's going to be stale, or even that you need to do a lot of exegesis right away. If you just go to the text and read it, God will make it fly off the page and will use it to restore you, put you together in a different kind of way. If you don't ever try it, you're starving. You do have to spend time figuring out what it means and studying and all that kind of thing. But there's a way, there's sort of a, I don't know if it's a word is devotional, but there's a way of reading the Bible day by day, morning by morning, that makes it, it props you up. It creates a spine on the back of you. You are put together by God. It might just be a word. It might be a whole verse. It might be an image or a passage. Like, God uses it to make you into a whole person.
I think part of the problem is, like, is two things. One, I think people are expecting this, like, mountaintop experience every morning or every day when they do it, and they don't get that. Right. So you're not going to get that every day or every morning. You're going to get food. Right? You don't have a mountaintop experience every time you have lunch. You just have lunch. But without it, you have starvation. So what we're talking about is something to make you spiritually normal.
Right.
Not something to make you, it's not a woo thing. You're going to be like just amazingly different necessarily in a day. It's a long-term feeding on good food kind of practice. And it does relieve it, you know, just prayer itself. Just, you get mad at me in the morning because I used to go in the other room and pray, and now because to be with you, you get mad at me. But it's such a relief valve. It's just, I mean, just being able to pour out all the stress that I feel, even if the stress isn't real or based on real things, that I can go on with the day. I can be okay in my own pray. I notice it. I notice I'm dragging, or I'm more tempted by things I usually am tempted by. I'm more, I don't know. I feel it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you don't have to like be a feelingless automaton, mm-hmm. Christian automaton, who never feels anything. Or it's that you bring your feelings and your emotions underneath the scripture and let them be transformed. Like, the whole point is, I mean, that's what's interesting about the transgenderism is it's this borrowing of Christian transformation and making it into something sort of grotesque and bizarre.
Yeah.
You know, but it borrows the category of repentance, of transformation, of the rather than adjusting your biology and your world to your feelings, you bring your feelings and emotions, which are very real and very powerful, under the rule of the Holy Spirit, and they can be changed. Like, they can be transformed. Maybe not in a, you know, complete way, the way that you would want, where you don't feel any sadness anymore, or, you know, all of your problems are solved, but you're gradually made into somebody who can cope.
Right. And I will say, it does sometimes resolve problems. You know, we've been praying about several things specifically over the last 2 or 3 months, and God has acted. Mm-hmm. He's answered our prayers in a clear way, an unmistakable way.
Mm-hmm.
And had we not been praying about it,
we wouldn't have noticed when he did anything.
Be things that he's, you know, James chapter 4, I think it says, there are some things he doesn't give you if you don't pray for it. So, I mean, who knows if these were those things. He's decreed from eternity to give certain things through prayer and other things not through prayer. And so, yeah, this is one of those things, I think. So it does actually change things. Or God actually changes things through prayer.
Yeah. So you should pray and read your Bible. That's what you should do. Just in these difficult times.
Yeah. I mean, it's really simple. Really simple. So as a church, we're going to do this by an Advent resetting ourselves by having a morning prayer Zoom thing, which I hope will help.
I do. I think it should like create a habit where no habit exists for some people. So, well, I think we should move on with the day and continue to enjoy the apocalypse as we have it here. Thank you for listening, and maybe we'll be back next week.